Caroline.
I'm Megan.
And I'm Shannon.
Welcome to Charm City Chief Chat, the podcast designed to support pediatric residents in Maryland's own Charm City.
Whether you're a seasoned senior or an intern navigating your first time on rounds, we're here to provide practical tips, expert insights, and real-world advice to help you thrive.
From the heart of Baltimore, let's tackle the challenges and joys of pediatric residency, one episode at a time.
Welcome to Charm City Chief Chat.
Welcome back to another episode of Charm City Chief Chat, and today we're diving deep into a topic that's essential for the world of nephrology, proteinuria and nephrotic syndrome. To help with the discussion today is one of our pediatric nephrologists, Dr. Alzarka. So Dr. Becker Alzarka is a pediatric nephrologist and the division head of pediatric nephrology and hypertension at the University of Maryland's Children's Hospital, and an assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. His clinical and research interests include inherited renal disorders, chronic kidney disease management, and kidney transplantation.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, jumping right in. I know we have all heard about proteinuria, but Dr. Alzarka, could you give us the actual definition of proteinuria and how to differentiate between microalbuminuria and macroalbuminuria?
Very good. So proteinuria, if you think about it, it's a marker of kidney disease. So that's why we use it a lot in the field of nephrology. So I think the big question always, like, is this something transient and you're going to see some proteinuria and you just need to make sure it's going away, but like you don't need more workup, versus if this is like persistent proteinuria. I think the definition of micro versus macroalbuminuria, if you look at literature, is only or mainly used for like diabetic patient. Because specifically in pediatrics, we talk more about like proteinuria versus albuminuria. Again, proteinuria, there's like different types. So it could be albuminuria, which basically you're just like taking the protein, but sometimes you have like other type of proteinuria. It's called like tubular proteinuria, which is like other proteins you're leaking. And again, as pediatrician, this is important for us because we deal with a lot of like congenital diseases and genetic disorders that could manifest as tubular proteinuria. So now we're going back to the definition. So proteinuria is the leak of protein from the kidney. So specifically from glomerular basal membrane for the glomerular proteinuria. We all leak some protein. So having a little bit of protein is considered normal. So that's why you see the definition. If we look at the lab values, it's not zero, it's normal. So usually for kids, we usually use like 150 milligrams in 24 hours. That's all of us as pediatricians, you know how hard it is to do 24-hour urine collection for a pediatric patient, regardless of their age, even older kids, even when they're admitted to the hospital. It's very hard to do. So what you usually do is we use another marker. It's called urine protein to creatinine. So basically, you can do it on a random urine, and basically, you divide the amount of urine protein by urine creatinine. And why we divide by urine creatinine? Because it's like urine creatinine production is constant. So basically, that's take out of the equation is that did the patient drink a lot of water before the test or not drink a lot of water? So that's concentration dilution factor you can get rid of by dividing by the urine creatinine. So normal is less than 0.2. So anything for urine, like let's say your urine protein is 100, your urine creatinine is 50. That's how we divide it. It's 100 divided by 50, and you get 2. So 0.2 is normal. For kids, like if we have a NICU baby or even toddler, like anywhere like less than 2 years of age, sometimes we allow them a little bit more protein and still consider it normal. So we say like up to 0.5 is considered normal. So what I will use instead of micro and macroalbuminuria, what we use, I think, more effectively is this nephrotic range of proteinuria or non-nephrotic range of proteinuria. Non-nephrotic range is anything above 0.2 up to 2, so 10 times the normal. Anything above 2, and again, you're going to see in the literature all the way somewhere between 1 and 3, but like most of the time we use 2. Anything more than 2 milligram of creatinine on a random urine sample, we call it nephrotic range. Why do we divide this non-nephrotic from nephrotic? First of all, like chances of being like a benign thing with nephrotic range of proteinuria is less likely. A lot of those transient proteinuria we talked about is like non-nephrotic, like it's low amount of protein. Two, for a lot of disease, it's also help us in like guidance. So sometimes if it's like non-nephrotic range, it doesn't require treatment. If it's nephrotic range, and I think we call it nephrotic range because it's high enough where you're going to leak significant amount of protein, where it's going to lead to hypoalbuminemia and all the cascade and end up causing you to be swollen. And that's why we'd like use this non-nephrotic range to nephrotic range. So it's less than 0.2 up to 2. We call it after that non-nephrotic or nephrotic range. And then for 2 years and younger, we use 0.5. Again, everything in pediatric, you know, you allow a little bit more for a young patient. It's just maturity, you know, like the glomerular-based membrane or your tubular function, all of that is maturing. The same thing why we let them have a little bit lower bicarb. The same thing we let them have a little bit higher. Like a lot of that is just related to maturity of like most organs, including kidney and tubules.
Now let's talk about the causes that cause us to have proteinuria. Can you give us an understanding of what situations would arise to cause protein loss in the urine?
So the causes, the way I think about it, and a lot of time when we see patients in clinic or in the hospital, is this a transient or is this like a kidney disease? Mm-hmm. So again, transient, a lot of time, like you have a kid who came to the emergency department who have like fever for any reason, a UTI or dyslipidemia, pneumonia, anything. A lot of time that inflammatory response, that body reaction in the kidney will be like some protein leak, some blood leak. So you could see a little bit of blood, a little bit of protein. And that's considered like it's just transient. And a lot of time I wouldn't do any workup for that. And a lot of when they check follow up with their pediatrician, if you check to your analysis, 99% of the time you're going to see the protein or the blood has gone. You don't need to do more evaluation. Nothing else need to be done. Again, we're always assuming in those scenarios, like the patient doesn't have any other symptoms. Like, look, if the patient have a full-blown symptoms of lupus, like they have rashes and ulcers and joint pain, and even if they have fever, I wouldn't assume it's like transient benign proteinuria. So in a lot of those cases, we're assuming the patient doesn't have any symptoms related to a kidney problem, like no swelling, nothing else. Most of the time is non-nephrotic range, but as I said, it's usually just related to that. The same thing happened with exercise. So that's another common reason for kids. Like if you had soccer practice and then you had your pediatrician visit right after, if you checked your urine, you may have a little bit of protein that's transient. A lot of time, like what day you don't exercise, or you, like Saturday is like your easy day, or Monday or whatever, let's just check another urine sample on that day and see where we are. So those are the two common causes of transient. The other one, I would say, it's not transient, but it's like non-pathologic. It's called orthostatic proteinuria. Again, as a pediatrician, we see it much more than our adult colleagues. We don't 100% understand why it happens. So it has something to do with the venous return pressure on the kidney because it has to do with your position. So if you're like laying flat, your kidney doesn't leak protein. When you stand up and walk, your kidneys leak protein. And a lot of the time, what we do is we just give the patient like a cup to take home. Hopefully they're sleeping, like they go to pee before bed and then empty their bladder. And basically once you wake up, you have that urine in your bladder is from like overnight while hopefully you're laying flat sleeping, not standing up. And then when you go to clinic, basically we check. So if the night one was negative, the morning one is positive. That's the definition of orthostatic proteinuria. This usually those patients are completely asymptomatic. They don't have any like consequences of that. So it's a benign thing that usually goes away. So those I will say like the benign non-pathologic thing. So transient and orthostatic. Now you get like, oh no, it's persistent, it's not going away, especially when associated with symptoms. That's where we think about like nephrotic syndrome in kids. That's the most common reason. Why you have nephrotic syndrome? Again, I think that's like the discussion. That's where most people don't like nephrology because of that discussion. I think it sounds confusing and a lot of time to tell you the truth. Like if it's not straightforward, like everything lapping exactly where we want it to be, it's very hard to make a prediction. Mm-hmm. And a lot of time, that's why you see a lot of time we depend on kidney biopsies to tell us what's going on. And a lot of kids prove us wrong all the time. I was expecting to see one specific thing, then I saw something other in the biopsy. But I will say, like, usually the protein in the urine that's lead to the hypoalbuminemia, that's lead to the edema, that's lead to the high cholesterol. And I will say, like, if we talk, like, just primary nephrotic syndrome, like, that's the main disease, that's the issue. As I would say, it's minimal change disease. That's in pediatric patients the most common. Like, almost 9 out of 10 will have minimal change disease. The second common one, FSGS or Focal Segmental Glomerulosclerosis. The third one is membranous nephropathy. Membranous is so rare in kids. And a lot of, it's like 1% of all nephrotic syndrome cases. So you can see how rare nephrotic syndrome, even 1% of that is membranous. Versus in adults, that's the majority. Like they have much more membranous and FSGS. And the same thing, like for our patient, if I have like a 2-year-old with nephrotic syndrome, most likely it's minimal change disease. If I have an 18-year-old with nephrotic syndrome, it's still likely to be nephrotic syndrome, but like the chances of having FSGS or membranous nephropathy become much higher than that 2-year-old. It's just as you get older, you see that distribution changes based on that. So that's what I would say, like minimal change disease is the most common. FSGS, membranous, they're very hard to tell, like without a kidney biopsy. The other thing, I think, make it a little bit more confusing, if it's not confusing enough now. A lot of those we say primary, but then there is like secondary causes. So that's like a systemic disease. Like with anything in medicine, we use a primary answer or whatever idiopathic you want to call it, or we use secondary. Secondary is like something else happened and that's what's causing you. So that's like lupus, that's vasculitis, that's ANCA vasculitis, that's like a bunch of other things, like connection line purpura. Like we use a lot of those vasculitis things. I mean, again, diabetes and they have like secondary proteinuria, or if you have HIV and you have HIV nephropathy. So a lot of those secondary, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, cancer can cause. I mean, we had a kid with like membranous nephropathy related to cancer. Mm. They removed the tumor, the nephrotic syndrome completely went away. So most of those secondary causes, you need to treat that secondary disease, whatever is going on. And sometimes the evaluation could extend, like it's not figured out what exactly is going on. But most of the time, as I said, so the main thing is minimal change disease. I think that's as a general pediatrician, most of the time, that's what you're going to see and that's what you're going to take care of. A lot of time, once you get up like to the FSGS and the membranous, I think that treatment vary a lot based on a lot of like different variable in patient, like how much protein, how old are they, why it's going on, is it genetics or not genetics? So I don't think you need to get into all of those details, basically. But I think a lot of time is just like knowing when do you need to do like further evaluation? Yeah. And I think is like, if you don't have any other clear reason, like you're not febrile, not exercise, it's not orthostatic, it's still persistent, I think that's where you need to move forward and do some of the evaluation.
When we're moving forward with an evaluation, or we have a kid where it's maybe less of a clear picture as to why they have this proteinuria, what next clinical step should we be thinking of?
Excellent. So I would say like the first step always is check at the urine again. A lot of time, you'll save a lot of worries from the parents and all of that. If you just repeat the urine analysis and confirm whatever you saw is still there. I will say if you have a patient who is completely in like already nephrotic syndrome, like they're puffy, I think that's like you just need to figure out like what's else going on at that point, like what's causing this. So I will do at that point, like usually we do like a renal function panel. That's what renal function panel versus BMP. It's a BMP plus albumin and phosphorus. The two things we like to know in patients with possible kidney problem where they have low albumin or high phosphorus. So I'll do like a renal function panel. A lot of time I will do a CBC, just looking on my, like a lot of time it's not very clear from the get-go if the patient has some kind of vasculitis. Like a lot of time we have somebody who comes and was like, yeah, I have some joint pain or may not. They may have a rash or not. Like it's just not very clear. So a CBC, looking at all your cell lines, you don't have anemia, you don't have thrombocytopenia, all of those things helps a lot. Because again, those like vasculitis patients, a lot of time they have leukopenia, they may have thrombocytopenia, anemia. The renal function panel tell you your albumin to make sure you truly have, like that's what's causing you to be edematous, is like the low albumin. I would definitely always quantify that proteinuria. So I will always send the urine protein and urine creatinine to see where we are, because it's one way to evaluate your response to treatment in the future. Like if you see your proteinuria is improving, that tells you it is working. A lot of time before we start patient, because as you probably know, most of the time their treatment related is steroids. So before we do that also, I like to check, like make sure I'll do the screening. Is the patient high risk for TB or not? Do I need to do a PPD versus a bone ball? Sometimes if I'm suspecting like secondary cause of nephrotic syndrome, like a little bit older patient, there is risk factor, I'll do hepatitis B, hepatitis C, HIV antibodies or testing. So you can do all of those things. That's mainly the workup. So as I said, the workup a lot of time is based on your physical exam and history as well. So again, if you have the patient with an action line purpura where they have the abdominal joint pain or the purpura crash, you have to go that route. If you have a patient who is suspecting lupus, I will add that anti double stranded DNA, ANA, or complement. If I have a kid who I'm suspecting like they're puffy because they have post strep, I know we're not talking about nephrotic syndrome anymore, we're talking about the glomerular nephritis. But my point, a lot of those things overlap, and a lot of the workup will depend on like what symptoms you're presenting with. And sometimes we'll do the first batch of lab and we don't get our answer, and you see we add the second thing where it could add like an ANCA panel or something like that. So that's how we usually like it, but I'll say the minimum is you're doing that's quantification of how much protein you have, you're doing your renal function panel, making sure your creatinine is okay, you're looking at your albumin, and you do like a CBC. I think that's what just tells you a lot before you start treatment.
So shifting gears to talking about nephrotic range proteinuria and nephrotic syndromes in general, we are going to discuss minimal change disease because we know that it is the most common. And so how do we evaluate for minimal change disease? Why are these patients presenting? What is the cause really of minimal change? And kind of what are those next steps?
So yes, I mean, I was to talk, minimal change disease is the most common type of nephrotic syndrome in pediatric patients. Usually most of those patients present with edema. Like that's how the presenting illness is, somebody with generalized edema. It's in the setting of infection. So a lot of like you have a URI or a GI bug or something set up an infection. So to answer your question about like why we have nephrotic syndrome, we don't know. So we know a lot of time it's related to the immune system for sure. So anything that's triggered the immune system usually trigger nephrotic syndrome. Is there like some genetic variation, you know, like a higher risk for that? I mean, possibly. There is a subtype that's very rare. It's called like genetic nephrotic syndrome or genetic FSGS. That's like completely different disease. That's you have something like a monogenic disease. That's you have like a single gene mutation causing you to have like dysfunctional protein in your kidneys that's caused you to leak protein. So every now and then we see those patients. Because it's like a genetic disease, it's in your DNA, it's very less likely to respond to any medication. But that's, as I said, like that's, we know why they happen, but like minimal change disease itself, we know it's related to the immune disease. The same concept of like, you have patients who have like more RP, like, you know, eczema and asthma and those kind of things, and nephrotic syndrome goes in that category actually with them. So usually you see it much more in patients who have that RP like background, basically. If you don't have the genetic disease, it doesn't run in family. So it's not like if you have one sibling, it's like more likely to have it than other kids or so. I would say with minimal change disease, I think the question is always with nephrotic syndrome is to biopsy or not to biopsy. And I think that's all depend on like how you're presenting. So remember we said like you have a patient, a young patient. So usually, and again, this is the reference will change from different people. But like if you have it somewhere between like probably 16 down to like 1.5 year old or so, if you're presenting in that age group and you just have nephrotic syndrome, you know, you have the edema, you have the low albumin, you have normal kidney function, you're leaking a lot of protein, there is nothing else going on. Like you don't have the weird rashes or joint pain, like nothing else going on. I think you can assume it's minimal change disease without doing a biopsy. So if you qualify for all of those things, so you don't have significant extra renal manifestations, or you don't have any other thing other than the edema, and you have, otherwise you're within that age group. I mean, if I have 17-year-old instead of 16, I may say, like, you know what, like, you don't have anything else, let's treat and see what happens. And the idea is what you do is you treat with the steroids. And your steroids is kind of marker of telling you, is this like steroid responsive nephrotic syndrome, which is, again, most likely will be minimal change disease. So usually we do like 4 weeks of steroids at least. And the idea is if you respond within 4 weeks, like if you go into remission, save yourself a biopsy. So you don't have to do the biopsy. You can assume. So that's why we use the word like we're assuming it's minimal. So you see in my notes, a lot of time I will write like assumed minimal change disease based on presentation, based on response to steroids. I think this is what's going on and we're not going to do a biopsy. Let's say now you didn't respond to steroids. At that point, what we call it steroid-resistant nephrotic syndrome. And that's a whole different disease. That's a, you need a biopsy. You need to add your genetic testing to see if you have like monogenic disease. You need to expand your workup. You need to check all the things if you didn't check it before, your Hep B and Hep C, like on all of. Hopefully you ruled out those before, as we said, like if you have risk factor. But I think at that point you'll have to expand your differential. So the treatment is mainly the treating the disease itself. Yes, you're doing steroids. So prednisolone for kids, prednisone for the pill form. And usually the dose is 2 mg/kg once daily, and it's maxed out at 60 milligrams. So even if you have like 100 kilos, you still do like 60 milligrams once a day. So usually we do that for at least 4 weeks. And then based on your response, we decide what we're going to do next. A lot of times, the next step is to wean it off. Like to, if you respond and you end the remission, we like start to gradually wean it off. There are some studies that show like actually if we do like a little bit prolonged course, like at least 2 months of steroids, the chances of relapses are less likely. If you're not responding to steroids, at that point we'll do all the evaluation we talked about. And then there is other medication that's like other immune suppression, mainly tacrolimus, CellCept. There is not much data recently on rituximab. There is all, again, this is also vary a lot based on where you're practicing, United States versus Europe versus Asia. Like there is a lot of different treatment out there for that. But staying on renal change disease, so the main treatment is prednisone. Now, other treatment is to treat the consequences of nephrotic syndrome. So a lot of patients will come edematous. And again, you guys see us most of the time, especially for like very, very young patients, a lot of time when they present, they have all the evidence of intravascular depletion. They have the hemoglobin is a little bit higher, they're hemoconcentrated, they're a little bit more tachycardic. It's very rarely to see them hypertensive, actually, on anything. Their blood pressure is on the lower side until we start the steroids, at least. And then you see hyponatremia. Hyponatremia because you're intravascular depleted, so that's sugar or ADH that lead to hyponatremia. So you do a lot of that. So the idea is if we replete some of that intravascular volume, that will make the patient pee more and get some of the fluids up. Because if you look at the total fluid for the patient is up, like they have more fluids than they need to. But all that fluids is the wrong space. They're not intravascular. They're actually, the intravascular space is depleted. So they have, and this is like rare scenario. Like you don't have like heart failure, liver disease, like cirrhosis and nephrotic syndrome. Like that's the only three scenarios where you could have like your total body fluids is up, but your intravascular volume is depleted. There's a lot of time, like other patients who you just resuscitated and you give them a bunch of fluids, like they're all compartments are up. But the nephrotic syndrome is the intravascular. So what we do is we try to replace with 25% albumin. 25% albumin is low in volume. So you have 25 grams of albumin and 100 cc of saline. Versus 5%, you only have 5 grams of albumin and 100% of saline or 100 cc of saline. The idea of 5% is more used for resuscitation. 25% is more used for diuresis. So you want to give the patient a lot of albumin to increase their oncotic pressure inside the intravascular space to pull fluids inside the vessels, and then they can pee out because their kidney is still working. But you don't want to give them a lot of volume because they're already swollen. So that's why where your 25% become much more handy than your 5% albumin. We give diuretics because, again, the same thing. The idea is we recruited the fluids inside the intravascular space, and now we want to pee. So that's why you don't want to start with diuretics alone. You can do albumin and then diuretics. And now if any adult nephrologist hearing this for any reason or anybody who take care of adults, they're going to be like, what are you talking about? Adults use a lot of time, they don't use 25% albumin. Mm. And again, there is a lot of studies on, again, I don't want to bore you with the details, but there is a lot of studies on like, why do we get puffy and nephrotic syndrome? And I think at some point we're going to have that final answer, but I truly think the etiology of the edema in kids and adult nephrotic syndrome are not the same thing. And one of the way we see it this sometimes, like we have some of our like adult patients, or not, kind of getting there, 17, 18 years old, who have nephrotic syndrome, and you see they don't present the same way we're talking about. They don't present with the hemoconcentration. They have the very high blood pressure. They're puffy. Those patients may benefit from diuretics therapy alone versus patient who is sign of intravascular depletion. If you give them just diuretics, they're already, because keep in mind, diuretics only work on the intravascular space. So if it's already depleted and then you're giving diuretics, the chances are you're going to form some cause-come problem, like more electrolytes problem, kidney injury. More importantly than all of that is blood clots. So there is a lot of studies on blood clots becoming much more likely when in young kids you give just diuretics without albumin. Versus in adults, as I said, you can see a lot of time is just a different combination of diuretics at the same time for nephrotic syndrome. So I think that's what the big difference is. So that's how we treat the edema of nephrotic syndrome. We give albumin and we give diuretics. So we talked about blood clots. That's the other thing of like consequences of nephrotic syndrome or minimal change disease. A lot of time you lose a lot of things other than albumin. So albumin is a pretty big molecule, like if you look at the molecular weight of protein. So you lose like protein C, protein S, antithrombin 3. You lose a lot of things important to the coagulation. You lose it on both sides. But the overall balance is you tend to form more blood clots. So we see, and we saw this in the hospital many times, you know, like the nephrotic syndrome due to lupus and the patient having bilateral PE or DVTs on like different kind of things. So that's the other thing. A lot of time, there is no indication in pediatrics to like prophylactically anticoagulate. Versus in adults, sometimes there is some like adults higher risk of blood clots, and they usually, in some occasion, depending on what type of, like if you have lupus and how much protein you have, because the protein is a marker of like how much you're losing, like or your blood clots factor. So there is some protocol, but like there is none in pediatric patients. So we don't automatically anticoagulate. The last thing is also you're losing a lot of important proteins for the immune system. So that's why the nephrotic syndrome, even without steroids, it's weakening your immune system. So that's why you see as a pediatrician, pneumococcal vaccine, 23 variant, that's indicated in nephrotic syndrome patients. So you don't have to have chronic kidney disease. Even your minimal change disease patient, after they completed their pneumovax, like serious, they should get their, or Prevnar, they should get the pneumovax, like 23, basically. So that's one of like the indication for that. Again, we'll always have like lower threshold for infection when you have when you have nephrotic syndrome. The reason that's why you see like spontaneous bacterial peritonitis, you have fluids in your belly, they're sitting there, your immune system is not working, you get much higher risk of like encapsulated bacteria causing you to have peritonitis. So I think, I'm mentioning those because again, a lot of time that's like the main thing you need to talk to family about, like on your discharge or on your clinic visit. It's like, this is the side effects of nephrotic syndrome. You get puffy, you get blood clots, you get infection. Be careful. You need to talk to them, like have lower threshold. If you all of a sudden you start having one extremity is swollen and have like sign of DVT, you don't have to explain to them like how DVT look like. Those kind of things. If like you're febrile and your belly is very tender to touch, like come back to the hospital. We need to like start this. Peritonitis is very serious infection that could get bad very quickly. So again, I think that's part of knowing those complications or that treatment is helps you a lot in like your anticipatory guidance for those patients. Again, you probably as a pediatrician should be very familiar with like steroids. We use it for a lot of disease. You should be familiar with like what do you tell parents when you put their kids on steroids for a long period of time. That's asthma, nephrotic syndrome, immune disease, GI disease, like a bunch of things we use it. And again, the effects on the growth, cataracts, risk of infection, body image, sleep disorders, appetite and weight gain, and all of those things, you should be able to talk to the family and give them a heads up. This is what's going to happen. This is some of the things we do to overcome that. Having healthier snacks if the kids is super hungry all the time, not like just give them like things that's going to make them get. And I saw this. Like somebody, we send them home to 2 weeks of steroids, come back to clinic, and they're like 20 pounds up in like 2 weeks. I've seen it so many times. And that's why you always try to talk to them to all of those side effects and like so that set them up to be successful in treating this. Otherwise, I mean, a lot of time you see people will not take the medication and then you end up back in the hospital, swollen again. And it's just like we've seen this circles many times. So hopefully that summarizes the treatment of minimal change disease.
Those were a great review and practical tips for pediatricians and pediatric residents alike.
So thank you so much, Dr. Alzeka, for joining us today. It was fantastic to hear about kind of all brought together the importance of our evaluation for proteinuria, its causes, how we're managing the nephrotic syndrome and focusing specifically on minimal change disease. It was wonderful to get to see and talk with you. Thank you so much.
No, absolutely.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Charm City Chief Chat, the podcast designed with pediatric residents in mind.
If you found today's episode helpful, don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review. You can reach out to us with podcast episode ideas at umdpedschiefs@som.umaryland.edu.
Please remember that all opinions expressed on this podcast are our own and not necessarily shared by our employer.